cartoons from present in the past. Every week will be an animated bash. Woo! What a cartoon! What a cartoon! Maybe a short but mostly sharp. We'll talk, we'll analyze, exploring as we go. What a cartoon!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to What a Cartoon Movie, where we sometimes talk about movies we wish were far, far away. I'm one of your hosts, the Wuss in Boots, Bob Mackey, and this is an audio exploration of every animated movie ever. Who is here with me today, as always?
Henry Gilbert, and I'm not accidentally in love with this film.
And this month's movie is, regrettably, Shrek 2.
Two can be as bad as one.
Donkey?
Shrek! Fiona! Well, aren't you two a sight for sore eyes? Give us a hug, Shrek, you old love machine!
And yes, nearly 5 years after covering Shrek 1, which I believe we released on the free feed as one of those we're taking the week off bonuses, we are back to talk about the sequel, which I think is a much worse film. For as much as I didn't like Shrek, I'm not a fan of this movie. More about our impressions later, but Henry, why are we covering this?
Well, this is our monthly What a Cartoon Movie podcast that we do only for our patrons at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, though we release a preview for it on the free feeds, and we do this every month. It's basically three extra podcasts of crazy deep history, even into something as seemingly regrettable as Shrek 2.
Yes, and if you sign up for the $10 level, you get to access the rest of the podcast. You're going to hear a brief part of the history. If you are just on the free feed or the $5 feed, the $10 feed folks are going to hear the whole thing. So if you want to hear the whole thing and get access to over 7 years worth of What a Cartoon Movie episodes, just go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up for 10 bucks a month.
And yeah, the Shrek one, I couldn't believe it has been almost exactly 5 years since we covered it. I mean, it's been 5 years since I got my first COVID vaccination shot. Like, that also doesn't feel like 5 years ago either.
Yes. COVID began a new period. They should just change what we call the years. We're now in COVID 6, post-COVID 6.
Yeah, like how on Star Wars Wiki, everything is like before Yavin or after Yavin or after Endor. Like, they only put years based on events in the movies. But yeah, that we covered, that one was only 4 hours long, and we released it on the free feeds as our holiday break one, just like we just did with the first Toy Story. That one we both had very direct memories of seeing in the theaters when it was new, but I don't think that's the case for either of us on Shrek 2.
No, yeah, I guess I can reiterate my Shrek 1 experience. I saw Shrek 1 twice in the theaters. I fell under Shrek's spell. It quickly wore off on me, like some sort of ogre curse. The spell dissipated, and I turned my back on Shrek, and I have not seen any of the Shrek sequels until I had to prepare for this podcast. So I have watched Shrek 2 now, and I have to say, not a fan. And it's making me appreciate Shrek 1 in ways I never thought I would.
I liked Shrek 1 well enough, though, on very first watch in the year 2001, though I did think it was a little too, needlessly dirty, or like in a cynical sense. Like, it's like, wait, is this being sold to kids, or is this a film full of jokes about the word ass in it? Which is it?
I guess I considered it lightly refreshing. And yeah, but the point of Shrek 1 is we're sick of Disney movies. We're sick of the formula. Let's shake it up a bit with this kind of frivolous, celebrity-driven animated comedy. And I would have been fine if that was it. But that just became the model for all animated movies for, 15 years. Maybe we're still kind of making Shreks in our own way. But yes, we're constantly having Shreks in the movie industry. Al, let's have Shreks.
The first movie, Shrek literally wipes his butt with the idea of a fairy tale and how tired and overdone they are. And then he becomes the mainstream thanks to the incredible success of the first one. And then every movie has to be the success of Shrek and the Shrek likes that followed the next few years killed 2D animation pretty much theatrically in the U.S.
And as I respect Shrek 1 in some ways, and now I appreciate it more after watching Shrek 2. And I think Shrek 2 has a problem that a lot of animated sequels have, in that in the first movie, the characters are their arcs. the entire movie is about them going through their arc. And once they go through their arc, there's nothing for them to do. So a lot of the sequels are just kind of treading water. So Shrek turns from a road trip about, you know, coming to accept yourself and, you know, overcoming these unfair beauty standards. And Shrek 2 is just like, here's a bunch of sitcom jokes we don't know.
Well, this came up in the history when I researched it, but if they really knew that there was going to be a Shrek sequel when they were starting the planning of Shrek, they would not have had it end in a wedding. Like, that was already the difficult situation. They're like, oh, wait, they not only got together, but they're married at the end of this. Like, that ruined a whole movie for us, basically.
Yeah, and I'm sure they wouldn't have killed Farquaad, which is why they brought him back for that ride as a ghost or something. Or there's some Halloween special. In some way, he comes back in a very small fashion, but I feel like he would have been the series' persisting villain because this fairy godmother's got nothing on Farquaad. Again, I didn't know how good I had it with old Mr. Fuckwad.
Yeah, Fuckwad is also part of the history, too. They considered it and then went back on it. But yeah, by the time Shrek had come out, like, we had been assaulted with so many things that already were like trying to capture Shrek, being marketed like Shrek. Also, we were, you know, deep into this came out in May of 04. It's already been going through like the Democratic primary. We're on our way. Like, it's a bad time in America. So I wasn't in the mood to go see Shrek 2 in a movie theater in May.
My name is Shrek and I'm reporting for duty. He saluted us all.
It was such a bad time in the world. And so, yeah, the May release of the film, I skipped it. I didn't see it until I basically half watched it enough times to count as one time because a coworker at the video store I worked at from 2006 to 2008 in Berkeley, California, they were slightly younger than me and they wanted to put on Shrek 2, multiple Shrek. So via osmosis, I eventually did watch Shrek, but this I think is the first time I have sat down and watched Shrek 2 from beginning to end, not just like in between doing a job at a video store. We were also like 20, you were 23. This was around your birthday, I guess, when it came out actually, right?
Yes, I would have just 22. Turned 22. Around this time. So clearly too cool for Shrek 2. When I was 19, I was in the pocket for Shrek 1. I think I saw Shrek 1 as I was about to turn 19. So I was still barely an adult, which is the best time to watch Shrek.
And a 3-year turnaround for this release also is incredible. That is one of the more interesting things in how quickly they made this and made it a priority. And just to put it into perspective, listeners, for where Shrek 2, how successful it was, in the global box office of 2004, it's the number one movie. It beat Spider-Man 2. Spider-Man 2, everybody thought Spider-Man 2 was going to be the big one of the year. No, Shrek 2 beat it by a few dozen million dollars in the global box office.
If I had to guess, this is probably the peak of Shrek because everyone went crazy about the first movie. It was, I think, at one point, one of the highest selling DVDs of all time, or perhaps the highest selling movie released on DVD for a time. So there was all of this built-in momentum for whenever this Shrek sequel would come out in these dreary post 9/11 days. Yes, we referenced 9/11 on the Shrek podcast. We have to.
And like the Shrek record not only was like for number one of 04, but also for a time, Shrek 2 was the most successful animated film of all time. Like, it was number one of all animated movies at the box office. It held that for 6 years until Toy Story 3 defeated it.
You know, I am so tired of that list now as someone who feels obligated to keep track of these things because I swear to God, there's a shakeup every year because every 2 years, Disney or Pixar will then release the highest grossing animated movie of all time and everything gets jumbled around.
Yeah, I didn't even bother to look up everything, but I wanted to see, like, okay, where's Shrek 2 now? The numbers have gone up so much since then. So 2010, Shrek 2 is number 2 to Toy Story 3. Now, Shrek 2 is 21. It's the 21st highest grossing. That's just how profitable animation is, which obviously got a ton of respect from the executives at film companies for animation since it makes so much money, right?
Sure thing.
I think I just saw like new depressing animation news today of like that Adobe's animation program, which is used by like tons of television series and animators, is just being sunsetted.
They're like, it served its purpose. It's crazy to me that nothing grosses higher than animated movies other than maybe Avatar. And the industry is still in the state that it's in. It's really sad.
Well, and Avatar, arguably, especially the last two, you know, are animated films. Like, there's very few humans in Avatar films.
Hmm. It's true. I'm gonna say this now on the podcast, and it's gonna come back to bite me in the ass. But if that new Mario Brothers movie, which I'm seeing because I'm a podcaster, if that becomes the number one highest grossing animated movie of all time, that's not a Chinese movie, then I will eat my hat.
You know,
not it's, really. I'm not gonna eat a hat, but I'll be very mad.
It could end up being the Shrek 2 of the Mario films. Of like, no, it'll make even more money than the first Mario because it's the sequel. Like, yes, I guess. Well, this does this mean I should be looking forward to chatting about it on a Retronauts? I'm up for it.
Yes, I mean, we have to.
Yes. To give you an idea of the Shrek franchise popularity, yes, Bob, you're correct. This is the highest grossing Shrek film out of all the six Shrek films, and we count the Puss in Boots spinoffs of that. Shrek is the second highest grossing animated franchise of all time, too, at around $4 billion, just a little over. It's second highest to the Minions / Despicable Me, which has made $5.6 billion.
Hmm.
And having seen enough of those movies, I think I'd rather watch a Despicable Me movie than a Shrek movie, though the Puss in Boots Last Witch wasn't bad.
I can't believe it's come to this, but when I revisit these Shreks, and to be fair, I've only seen two of them, the hideous character design, it is repellent to me. They look like melted Sims, and the closer they get to looking human, the more repellent they get. Like, I'm kind of fine with, you know, Pinocchio and the Gingerbread Men, but when a Shrek becomes a human, I want to vomit. And he's a human for, like, what, 20 minutes of this movie?
A very long time. And you're supposed to think he is hot. Like, he is
really
a sexy man. Yeah.
They should have just made him look like Mike Myers. That would have been great.
At least in the world of, like, in the character designing of Despicable Me, I like the cartoonish proportions of character. They're not trying to make Gru look like a person. Like, they're having fun with him being a cartoon.
I love the design of Gru. I'm pretty cool with the designs of the Minions. Those are movies that are kind of fun to look at. I'm not a fan of the writing or the jokes as much, but Shrek 2, I don't know what their intent was, but I feel like, oh, we want photorealism is sort of, that's the vibe I get. We want to make this look as realistic as possible so we're not going to alienate people who don't want to watch a cartoon.
Yeah, well, and also the way they've, from the beginning with Shrek 1 and into Shrek 2, the way they're marketed is just like they make the voice actors so in the front. They're just like, no, this is like a real movie. Like, this is like a real event movie starring real people. You're watching this like you're watching a Mike Myers or Eddie Murphy movie, not a movie that has their voices in it. So where does this take us in the history of Shrek and the DreamWorks Animation Studio as well as we're returning to finally chat again about Jeffrey Katzenberg? It's been a few months since we've talked about him, I think.
Yes, he didn't work on the Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special or Sleeping Beauty or whatever November was. I forget what that was, and I produced it. What was that?
Oh, wait, which one? Before that? It was Fantastic Mr. Fox, and then...
Okay, yeah, that's right, sorry.
But Katzenberg's shadow was cast so far that I think he definitely was somebody we talked about for, like, Treasure Planet and Lilo and Stitch and Atlantis. Like, mm-hmm. he was even there in the early stages of that, but... look up the Shrek podcast that we did for the first Shrek. I give like a whole history on DreamWorks Animation, but short version is Jeffrey Katzenberg leaves Disney acrimoniously because he wanted to be number two there to Michael Eisner, starts DreamWorks SKG with Spielberg and Geffen. He is in charge of the animation. He wants to make it fancy animation and do prestige things like The Prince of Egypt. And one of his big projects from the beginning was Shrek that was going to star Chris Farley. Chris Farley dies. It goes through all of these changes. They put it out in 01 from the team that made Ants, and it ends up being a gigantic success that none of them could have predicted. At the same time, DreamWorks' 2D stuff not doing so great.
Yeah, I believe we mentioned on that podcast how animators were sent to work in the Shrek mines when they had nothing to do. It was just this project that was constantly under redevelopment.
Yeah, Katzenberg had been like promised all of these tech things. Like in 1996, he was told, oh, motion capture can make a whole movie right now of Shrek. Like film actors moving like this was, he was promised something that they can barely make a movie now with it even, like movie quality stuff. He was told in the mid-90s it could be done until they eventually just then asked the people who made Ants, can you just take over this Shrek thing and we'll just throw people at it? It was not supposed to be that big of a success instead of being like, basically the thing that saved DreamWorks Animation.
Now, I'm not sure if this is in your timeline, Henry, but I did note that the author of the book that Shrek is based on, William Steig, he passed away in 03. He saw what was coming, or he was also 100 years old. But I think it's not a coincidence that he departed this plane right before Shrek 2 launched.
2 years of living in the world where the first Shrek existed out of his creation, he's like, I can't take it anymore, guys. I'm out of here. So, yes. Katzenberg was so high on the original Shrek. During production, they already were planning a sequel, though that was pretty standard. Then Disney pretty much was doing it. Like, that's why there was an Atlantis and a Tarzan and all of these sequels out, that it just turned into a difference of, will this be a direct-to-video or will this be theatrical? You're always planning the sequel then.
Right.
So they're working on it up to the May 2001 release. And after that's such a big hit, that's when Katzenberg is like, okay, then this is definitely going to be a theatrical release. And Katzenberg is so high on it, too, that, like, lucky for them, they had just created at the Oscars the Best Animated Feature Award that Shrek could compete for. He even put out ads in the trades, like Variety, for your consideration for Best Picture. Like, he was thinking Shrek could be like Beauty and the Beast and get a Best Picture nom in the 2002 awards for films of 2001.
And that did win the first Best Animated Feature Award, correct?
Yes, defeating Monsters, Inc. and Jimmy Neutron. Yes.
One of those should not even have been nominated. I will say, maybe Shrek, not Jimmy Neutron. What were we thinking?
I read like the history of why they finally created it. They never had it before in decades and decades, because they're like, well, it's just going to be like, it's one Disney movie and there's no other cartoons we even nominate, right? And they were finally, after the 90s, they realized, okay, there's enough animated features in a year. We can nominate them. And then when the first year they have to settle for Jimmy Neutron, Boy Genius, is like your third nominee, that probably had them reconsidering it. But it was fun. They even animated Shrek and Donkey in the audience reacting and cheering to their award. I always like when cartoons are animated to be part of the awards.
Yeah, that was the highlight of the Oscars when I was a kid. Like, Goofy's going to accept the award, or Buzz and Woody are in the audience.
Only seeing the Muppets there was more important. You know what? They're giving a big new push for the Muppets right now. The Muppets better be presenting an award at the Oscars this year.
Maybe they got that Jeff Keighley stink on them now, and they're not allowed into legitimate award ceremonies.
Ugh. I hope they're done with Keighley now after all that. They're too good. I hope they become too good for Jeff Keighley after this Sabrina Carpenter special. They don't need him anymore.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So this led to the rebirth of DreamWorks Animation as a company. That's why this movie has the debut of the new logo at the start of it. Like, that was like, no, we're spinning off fully from DreamWorks, as DreamWorks is kind of up and down with its releases. They always could have like a Spielberg hit and some other hits, you know, like Saving Private Ryan is a DreamWorks release. But they weren't always that successful outside of those films. Like, Transformers is also a very successful DreamWorks franchise, I should say, too.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned this on that podcast, that original Shrek podcast. I was so excited about DreamWorks as a kid. Yeah. Not knowing the expression, too many cooks.
they presented it as the first movie studio in 30 years or something. Like, it's finally a movie studio for us in our, because we knew who Steven Spielberg was, even as like 13-year-olds. We knew him.
Yeah, I mean, then I heard Katzenberg was associated with all these Disney movies, and a lot of the bands I loved were on Geffen Records label.
I knew that Geffen logo from the Simpsons Sing the Blues album. So this is, you know, July 2001, as they're getting started on the production. This is also when it makes big news that Mike Myers, Eddie Murphy, and Cameron Diaz are setting records for paydays, because they apparently did not have a sequel clause in their contract, so they could renegotiate it. They are going to get paid $10 million each for the movie, $5 million up front and $5 million after. It was a record at the time that they credit to Eddie Murphy's management. It was really just Eddie Murphy's manager was talking it up, while meanwhile Myers and Diaz had like favored nations rules, which means that you can't be paid less than the top guy in the acting group. So if Murphy gets a raise, so do the other two actors. They did do pretty good on the first movie, because they were paid basically scale up front, but with incentives based on the gross, and they made roughly $3 million each.
Points? Were they getting points?
And the points actually paid off because they're famous actors, I think. That's why they actually got money. But yes, $10 million, it was setting a record. I think, I don't know now, it seems like after, say, Inside Out 2, it seems like they're getting stingy with the famous people, unless you're like Amy Poehler.
Yeah, yeah, it's funny that we're seeing these huge deals now. I think the huge deals now are why they're not happening anymore for anyone. Because yeah. Disney's pretending like, we can't afford Mindy Kaling.
Yes,
what do we look like?
Bill Hader's too famous now. No way can we afford Bill. Yeah, it's crazy to and to also know that, like, oh, they, when you see the people who replace, like, Mindy Kaling and Bill Hader, they're good actors who I like, but then it's like, oh, so you, I don't want to call them scabs, but it's like, oh, I guess good for you that I know that you cost less than Bill Hader does.
They're being a little scabby, I'll say it.
Well, because there are successful actors who don't, like, need it, but that's, this is a whole other tangent, but, like, no famous actor needs to be in any commercial now, but they don't have shame anymore. Like, I've complained about this a lot. I'm thinking about it, too, because we're on the verge of the Super Bowl when we're recording this. The Super Bowl ads are out now. Did you injure yourself, Bob, watching that Jurassic Park commercial? It's pretty horrible.
Did I injure myself? Well, I didn't see this commercial. Did I punch my TV?
It made me very sad to watch the Xfinity commercial with the Jurassic Park actors. Have you not seen this?
Oh, okay. So this is sort of like we're recreating scenes, but it's a commercial for Xfinity?
Yeah, basically the concept, which isn't unfunny, is that the story of Jurassic Park happens, but as the computers are all shutting down, then an Xfinity tech shows up to reestablish their internet, and then everything goes fine. And they get the main stars of the movie, Sam Neill, Jeff Goldblum, and Laura Dern, back to act out the movie, except they are digitally de-aged. That is the horrifying thing.
I was just going to ask about that, because yes. I kind of enjoy that technology when it's necessary. Like, I've been watching the new Fallout, and there are some scenes in the past, and they de-aged Kyle MacLachlan. I'm like, well, it's a lot less spooky than it used to be, and you're not, like, constantly showing me close-ups of the face. But when you're using it to recreate moments from 30-plus years ago, it's a little icky.
To see also, like, the most famous, one of the most famous and watched films of all time, where everybody knows what everybody looked like in it, and then they're, like, grafting the young faces onto the current aged actors who have aged all gracefully, but they don't have the faces they had in 1993.
I would kind of rather take a movie with that technology than the last five Jurassic World movies.
Yeah, I guess so. That's well, I do agree, and this applies to Mike Myers, just to bring it back to the Shrek zone. I would rather Mike Myers just play Dr. Evil in a Super Bowl commercial than make more Austin Powers or something like that. Like, just keep these sequels to Super Bowl commercials. But
it might be a little too late now.
But famous actors, they don't have any shame anymore. They do every commercial possible. They take up all the money, and it's like, but what? Don't you have enough? Don't you? You're already millionaires. Like, but anyway. Oh, hey, speaking of people getting raises and things expanding, Pacific Data Images. Let's talk about the animation studio, because 2001 was a big year for them, too. After Shrek's big success, DreamWorks, who already had deals with them to make more movies, they locked that shit down. They bought out the majority of it, and DreamWorks Animation became the primary owners of PDI in 2001.
Smart.
Pacific Data Images, they got their start actually doing special effects, digital special effects, in 1980. That's when they began. And this was the year they stopped doing special effects. They finished all the special effect deals they had. The last times they're credited on special effects is Minority Report from 2002, the Spielberg movie. So they're only focusing on DreamWorks after that.
I mean, I don't blame their hard work for the reason this movie looks so hideous. I feel like it's a top-down directive for this movie to look the way it does. But we are still in the earlier stage of CGI. And I recall when we watched The Incredibles for this podcast, I did note, like, oh, I'm surprised. I'm starting to note, though, the lighting's a little flat here. This looks a little awkward. So now that we've come so far, you can really point out the flaws of this early CGI.
And in this movie, there's so many scenes that are supposed to be like the wow, like the Jurassic Park Brontosaurus moment. They're supposed to be like, wow, look at the hair move on this character. Look at this special effect. Like there's supposed to be a lot of that in Shrek 2, but they have not aged very well in the 22 years since. And Pacific Date Images, they not only are working on Shrek, they are fast-tracking Shrek. It leads them to have to postpone and then eventually cancel a film they actually announced. I had never heard of this film. I'm not a PDI historian. I had not heard of this film. Tusker was the name of it they had announced. I had not heard of this project before.
New to me, too. Is this a walrus film?
Elephants. It's elephants. Okay. Yeah. So, and honestly, I'm glad they didn't make it because it also just feels like, well, but DreamWorks, you already released Chicken Run. Why are you making the Dirty Dozen with elephants? Like, you already kind of have an escape movie with chickens.
Yeah, it seems a little redundant. And you can't get better than Chicken Run. I'm sorry.
So, like, Tusker was announced, and then they're like, oh, we're going to have to postpone this while they focus on Shrek 2. It was supposed to have the voices of Morgan Freeman, Jodie Foster, and Dana Carvey. Poor Dana Carvey, the other half of Wayne's World. He gets screwed out of the big DreamWorks money while Mike Myers is just swimming in it like a Scrooge McDuck.
He really needed a win after The Master of Disguise. It's a shame.
Oh, man, maybe that the BO for that led them to just cancel it. They're like, all right, Dana Carvey's time is over.
No longer hot.
Also, though, Pacific Date Images had become a more than two projects at once studio. Like, that's how big they had gotten because starting in 2001, while also working on Shrek 2, they were working on an idea they had had of what if zoo animals went back to Africa and had a bit of a culture shock.
It'll never work.
The original cast of the film that would eventually become Madagascar included Madonna, Ricky Martin, and Mel Gibson. So, you know, they dodged a bullet there, I'd say.
Yeah, we dodged a bullet. We almost covered this movie with the We Hate Movies guys for their podcast. I think we had a choice between that or the Simpsons movie.
Oh, God, boy. I'm glad. I'll cover the Simpsons movie a fifth time with them before I'd like to watch Madagascar. But you know what? I'd watch Madagascar before Shark Tale. I would watch, you know what? No, Shark. Well, I don't know.
I don't know. I think that the character designs of Madagascar are not revolting.
Though Shark Tale has such an interesting story behind it, just in like, I really would like to dig in. When did they fire James Gandolfini? When did they decide? He was supposed to be the mean shark brother of Jack Black in that movie. When did they fire him?
Oh, damn. I had no idea.
But yes, so they're working on Madagascar as well. That's slowly coming to fruition. But Shrek 2 is their main focus. So by mid-2001, there's the news of the sequel being fast-tracked, and writers who we talked about, the screenwriters for the first Shrek, Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio, are still working on it. We've covered them a lot. Bob did a great history on them for Aladdin as well. They are major Hollywood writers of things. They worked on some version of Treasure Planet. When I covered them last was on Treasure Planet because they were complaining about all the changes made to Treasure Planet after they left the script, I think.
I'm pretty sure they were a big part of some version of The Road to El Dorado as well.
Yes. Yeah. They were a favorites of Katzenberg for sure. And then they would move over to Pirates of the Caribbean. Like that was their like biggest franchise. Mm-hmm. That was what was so funny in Treasure Planet. The guys who wrote Treasure Planet then leave Treasure Planet to make the actual successful pirate franchise for Disney. So Elliot and Rossio, they're working on this film, but apparently it's not going good for them pretty early. Like by about November, if not earlier, it's announced that they have left the project. They said that it was a creative difference. In a interview by the end of 2001, they were asked, why are you leaving? And they were being nice. But they vaguely explained that they pitched a story that they wanted to keep dealing with fairy tale conventions and that the story that was chosen was one that does not deal with those, which I don't know what happened there. This movie definitely deals with fairy tale conventions. I think that's in the script for sure.
Yeah, but I feel like it is more focused on these sitcom-y elements more than whatever Ted and Terry's screenplay would have focused on.
I mean, there's a very specific movie they're parodying here that has little to do with like the stories of Prince Charming. Like, I mean, he is in this movie, but it's a side tangent subverting the fairy tale conventions of Prince Charming in this movie, I'd say.
Yeah, the first movie was just a tour of fairy tale parodies, and they kind of had done them all.
So that's why when they instead get to far, far away, it's like, well, it's just Hollywood. We're just going to do every joke about Hollywood we can do. Also, a key bit of interview info from the interview I don't think I had caught in our first Shrek history was when they wrote the original script, they wanted Fiona to transform into an entirely different creature. They wanted her to be like a different scary monster. It was a fight that they lost with Katzenberg because they're like, well, we don't want her to just be another ogre. Like, we want her to be like a different monster to make it not as obvious or direct. And like Katzenberg, like, no, we want it to be a hot ogre. That's what she's going to be.
That would have been interesting. Honestly, like, a lot of my issues with this movie are the character of Fiona because she's the most post-arc boring version of her former self. There's nothing for her to do. I don't know what her personality is. And honestly, Cameron Diaz, I don't really like her as a voice actor. She's not drawing on, like, an established personality or anything. So she's just, like, Fiona, the performance, the character, everything's just very flat. And I guess the joke is, oh, it's funny that she farts like Shrek.
Yeah, her bodily noises are about it for her, which I guess is also trading on that, like, the persona she had from some of her movies of being like, oh, she's one of the guys type characters she's played, which and I have enjoyed Cameron Diaz in movies. I liked her. I think she was very good in There's Something About Mary. I liked her in the Charlie's Angels movie. I think she was my favorite of the three angels in, well, the first one. I actually didn't watch the second Charlie's Angels.
Yeah. I mean, when she's good, she's really good, but it wasn't really until I listened to the Blank Check commentary for The Mask that I realized how much her career just really fizzled out.
Though now she's back. She was just in, like, I'm Back movie with Jamie Foxx for Netflix, which, hey, congrats. And now she's back for, spoilers, folks, Shrek 5. She's back for that, too, for another big payday. Also, not only did they lose that battle with Katzenberg, but reading between the lines of that interview, I think the writers, the original screenwriters for Shrek 2, they wanted to explore much more like, okay, what is the deal with her transformation? Let's let that be the movie. Like, that is a story to explore with Fiona, like make it a Fiona-focused film instead of making it about how, like, it's still about Shrek dealing with Fiona's family instead of, I wanted an answer of like, okay, why does Fiona transform? What happened? Why does this happen?
And this movie's about Shrek. Well, now he's insecure and closed off in a different way. And I'm thinking, we've done this. I was there. Shrek learned a lesson.
So this is when they exit the job. They're very busy screenwriters. And so late 2001, it's announced that two more writers are pulled in who actually get credited as screenwriters on this movie. J. David Stem and David N. Weiss. Their hot new animated film duo. They wrote that Jimmy Neutron, the Oscar-nominated Jimmy Neutron. They wrote the first two Rugrats movies. They wrote the Jonathan Frakes director jail film Clockstoppers.
Oh, okay. Well, boy, I can't recall if the writing in Jimmy Neutron was good. It was another hideous-looking animated film.
And I did not remember this until I looked at it, but Bob, I'm sure, did a great history on them back in the COVID year because they wrote two episodes of Mission Hill, Porno for Pyro, and the unanimated Kevin versus the SAT.
Oh, those guys, yeah. If you go back to our very old podcast, I'm sure there's a bio for both of them.
But it shows, too, that they're like, oh, let's hire, like, Simpson-adjacent guys because that's also the other screenwriter I'll talk about in a second, but this is like Simpsons adjacent people who they're hiring to write on this. It's at least them seeing the type of movie they want to make comedy wise. And these two guys would follow their Shrek 2 success into writing Are We There Yet? And the two Smurfs movies, the first two Smurf movies, not like the other three Smurf movies have happened since those two.
Well, I don't think I like them is what I'm going to say.
Porno for Pyro is a good Mission Hill episode, though. That's
sure,
a good one.
Sure.
Yeah.
they had good stewards with Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein helping them along the way.
If Bill and Josh had been there to boss them around on Smurfs, the Smurfs movies would have been much better, too, I bet. But this is where the real storyteller of the movie comes in, and that's Andrew Adamson, who was the co-director on the first Shrek. I, you know, gave a history on him before, but a quick version is he's a New Zealand-based animator who he got his start in PDI as a special effects guy first before, you know, transferring over into directing the film. And it turns out he actually has very good narrative abilities. He isn't just a guy who can make explosions or lasers in special effects program.
And because he's from New Zealand, he probably calls the movie Shriek.
Shriek. I love Shriek.
I'm working on Shriek.
So he was the co-director on that movie, the first Shriek, along with Vicky Jensen, who we talked about her too. And they, and funnily enough, it sounded like I was going back over those notes. Vicky and Andrew, they made the movie very separately. They basically, they didn't co-direct in sharing scenes. They co-directed in, I'll take this half of the film, I'm directing this half of the film you're directing, and hopefully we'll finish this in time for our deadline.
Okay, so they're kind of like sequence directors.
Yeah, and so that's why Adamson, I think, could be picked as the first like main director for it. Originally, he was supposed to be the only director on the film. And this is where he would come up with the idea. He is the one who pitches the idea to Jeffrey Katzenberg that sticks after their rejecting of the original screenwriter's idea, which he writes an outline. And this is in the history, the art book for Shrek and Shrek 2. They say they did not do this before, but they went straight from his approved outline to starting to board before they then started writing a script for it. That's how quickly they needed to get shit going on this movie. Basically, Adamson's idea was, guess who's coming to dinner? That was the idea. That is named specifically in the art book, so they're not even hiding from it.
Topical in 2004?
Yes, it's instead of a story about race relations in America, what if the African-American man was an ogre?
I'm sure it's a good film, but I never watched it because it seems like, well, we've moved on past this era. Perhaps,
or
at least I hope so.
Yeah, no, yes, I hope so too. I've seen clips from it. I never saw it either. It seemed, but I mean, yes, the idea of, you know, your daughter, you're a white couple, and then your white daughter brings home her new boyfriend who is a black man. Like, I can see why that was a controversial and memorable film in the 60s as well. Recall the resolution of it is one of, you know, equality and respect, and the father, I believe Spencer Tracy, comes to accept his daughter and her choices and her boyfriend and is, stops being racist.
Yeah, I guess it was a better movie to watch when right after race mixing laws were off the books.
Yes. Yeah.
Now we're both in interracial marriages, Henry. We're like, yawn. Yes. I'm coming to dinner every night.
Well, I guess to also show where things are, too, a year after Shrek 2 comes out is an actual direct remake instead of partial remakes like Shrek 2. The Bernie Mac, Ashton Kutcher, Zoe Saldana film, Guess Who, is showing how progress is. It is the black family has to meet the white boyfriend of their black daughter. That's the reverse situation, was how it was sold.
And I'm looking at this. Oh, it made a lot of money.
That was also another video store watch
okay.
That I saw.
My joke is going to be, guess who's not seeing this? The country of America, but a lot of people saw it.
Well, it never came up in any of the research I did, maybe because they wouldn't want to admit it. I do think they're a little inspired by the then recent success of Meet the Parents, don't you think? Like,
yeah, completely. You know what? Yeah, that was one of the first thoughts I had when sitting down to watch this, because Meet the Parents was what, 2001? 2000?
It's definitely after 9/11 because there's like a bomb on an airplane joke in it. It's,
yeah.
Was it 02? I feel like they all happened so quickly.
You know, we're using computers to record this. Yeah. There's no way to know. And it is 2000. It's the year 2000.
Oh, it's 2000. Oh, yeah. So they were doing a bomb on an airplane joke before 9/11. Wow, man. So yeah, I definitely think in a meeting when they sold this, they're like, oh, it's like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner meets Meet the Parents. But I will tell you this. I know from reading so many histories, if you compare your plot idea to a movie that was released in the time when Jeffrey Katzenberg was a young man, you are much more likely to sell your film than if you don't.
That's like pitching jokes in The Simpsons when Al Jean was the showrunner.
It's like, hey, Al, this is like, have you ever heard of Old Man in the Sea? Oh, hey, sold right there.
I've got a killer West Side Story parody. Let's go.
Oh, and also Adamson would parlay his success in this into he would not work on the next Shrek films. He became the guy of the mid-aughts Narnia franchise. Like, he co-wrote and directed the first The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe film, and then worked on the following two of the Narnias as well. But so they approved the Guess Who's Coming to Dinner idea because, as Adamson explained, he was like, well, you know what? We ended with the wedding, so we can't do the wedding. And this is like, well, is Happily Ever After promised to all of us? What if we explore the, like, you know, I would bet her family isn't going to be happy to see that their daughter has become an ogre now and her new husband is a guy who lives in a swamp and farts all day. Though, if you graft it too much onto Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, then her becoming an ogre herself also, yeah. I feel like that has more bad metaphorical concepts.
Yeah, it's very, like, these things don't really map well, and that's a problem when you're doing these, like, racism analogies where it's like everybody hates this one class of people, but they're also like smelly or murderers or they eat onions.
Yes. Yeah, it's like, well, I mean, these ogres are pretty violent and mean. Like, it's just, if you expand it too much, it gets weird. So yes, they start working straight away on it. He's working with his story artists. And then by mid-2002, it's announced that they get their last credited screenwriter on the film, also working a ton with the story team. That is Joe Stillman. He was working a lot on DreamWorks animated features, but we've covered a lot of stuff of his.
Yes, King of the Hill, The Adventures of Pete and Pete, a quality writer.
And I think he got into film thanks to co-writing Beavis and Butthead Do America with Mike Judge.
Oh, that too, that yeah.
Was, yeah. So again, this is smart hire. They're getting a guy who's working in Simpsons adjacent world, who knows how to write for animation and has now proven himself there. He's working on a lot of DreamWorks stuff back then. Based on what I was reading, I think this, I don't know for sure, but I'm thinking he just helped them finalize the script into, like, they were already doing all the work on the film, and he really just helps them clean it up into, like, a final idea for the movie. This is also in mid-2002 when he is assigned co-directors, where Adamson gets co-directors. Though it's interesting, you see in the credits, it's like directed by Andrew Adamson, then directed by two more names. They're not co-directors. They are equal directors, but they're on a different page, which still shows, like, to me, the primary director is Adamson. Then the other two are co-directors.
Yeah, that's what it seems to indicate to me.
So they're officially hired in 2002. One is the late Kelly Ashbery, a 1980 CalArts graduate who is a Disney Features vet, got hired on to DreamWorks pretty early on, a co-director on Shrek 1 below Adamson and Vicky Jensen on that movie. He then works on Spirit, and then after Spirit comes out in 2002, that's when they're like, okay, buddy, you need to get over here and help us finish Shrek 2. We got to get this done.
All hands on Shrek.
he'd follow the success of this to work on Gnomeo and Juliet. He directs that. He directs Smurfs, The Lost Village, and the Ugly Dolls film. So that's...
I feel like if you had children in the 2000s, you've seen all of these.
You know, again, when you have to see these things, I would watch Minions 3 every day before Gnomeo and Juliet. Yeah,
I remember like my wife and I were at the movies, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. We saw a trailer for the Ugly Dolls movie. And that's when I learned ugly stands for you gotta love yourself. So it has a great message.
We all learned something that day from that trailer. Didn't need to see the movie. The trailer.
I refused to see it.
But yes, he sadly, though, passed away in 2020, only at the age of 60. So R.I.P. Kelly Ashbery. Then the other co-director is Conrad Vernon, another CalArts graduate who then went on to work on Bakshi projects. He was in the, you know, Spumco adjacent world before getting into to feature stuff. He was a standout story artist on Shrek. They loved his work so much that they're like, you know what? You should just voice this gingerbread man character because you're making all of these scenes so funny.
Yes, I love when we get to the characters clearly voiced by animators.
Yes, it's when I was looking at the cast of this movie, it's like a dozen very famous people and then people who are animators.
Yeah,
that's the mix.
I mean, we're going to get to the movie, but I feel like they really deploy Pinocchio and Gingerbread Man because they are thinking the movie's over and we got nothing. How about these guys you liked before?
I did laugh that these characters who were kind of fan favorites in the first movie are just sitting around watching TV until like the 70th minute of the movie where they come in for jokes.
It feels a little desperate, but I enjoyed their antics.
So yes, Conrad Vernon, voice of Gingerbread Man, and he will go on to be a big deal co-directing on Monsters vs. Aliens, Madagascar 3, Sausage Party, both Addams Family movies. Would you like those, Bob? I haven't seen them.
One is okay. Second one is kind of a letdown. They're fine. I like how they look. Clearly, they didn't really go anywhere because I think the second movie really flopped.
Well, now after leaving the nest, he's back for Shrek 5. He's currently a co-director on Shrek 5. Back in the loving embrace of Shrek in DreamWorks Animation. Those are the other two directors. Vicky Jensen did not come back to the film because she was instead shoved over to Shark Tale, which was originally, I think, called Shark Slayer. So she was on her own like five alarm fire of a movie to fix. That's why she couldn't direct Shrek 2.
Yeah, I recall that movie came out before Shrek 2, but it actually came out a few months after Shrek 2.
Yes, yeah, it was. This I think, was the first year they put out two CGI films in the same year for DreamWorks Animation. They marketed that movie so hard. Like, I think there's very funny to look at pictures now of, like, Will Smith, Angelina Jolie, and Jack Black, like, riding around on a, like, giant inflated version of the Vish from that movie that he plays, that Will Smith plays. It's very strange to look at now. This is also like the tech got a big boost in between films. Like that always happens in CGI back then. I bet if we talked to somebody who worked on like a 2020 and a 2025 Pixar movie, they could point out a million things that are tech upgrades, but it never feels like the same tech upgrade that it used to feel like.
Yeah, it's maybe once we're 10 years out, we could see how Zootopia 2 looks dated compared to whatever, Zootopia 7. But it's really hard. Once, like after 2010, maybe 2015, things don't look really dated anymore in the world of CGI, but again, I think with time they will.
I mean, I think that's that way with video games too, that like sometimes I play a PlayStation 5 game and I think, can this really not be done on a PS4? And then I can see like, oh no, this would be chugging along. This can't do all of these things. There are clear differences, but it never, perhaps this is also just aging, but nothing feels like going from a PS1 to a PS2 anymore.
Well, the good news is I feel like we're going to be stuck in this generation of gaming forever because no one can afford to make games of that level of quality in terms of images and production. And also everyone is buying up RAM and hard drives for data centers, so we can't have new computers or anything. So I'm fine with playing PS5 games for the rest of my life. I think we've reached the zenith. It's fine. No more possibilities are available.
Didn't they also have to like price increase both the Xbox and the PlayStation recently?
Yes, I think that too. It's the first time when consoles have gone up in price.
So like I feel like it used to be there was a $500 like ceiling for a new console. They're like, well, they tried to sell a $600 PlayStation 3. People didn't want it. Like, I feel like there's no economical way they can sell a $500 PlayStation 6,
no.
Right?
I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm glad I bought a hard drive recently.
So in Shrek 2, though, they're really showing off all of their changes since the first one. That's why there's so many more human characters in it, because they are like, oh, skin and hair and lighting and the crowd size. Like we can do so much more than the first movie.
Yes, they're really showing off their cha-cha-cha changes, a song you'll hear in this movie when somebody changes.
Ugh. Man, give them credit that they recorded a new song for it instead, a new version. And that's why one of the main characters of the movie, the big new character they're betting on, is a furry character to show off their new hair technology as well.
Now, I liked his design. It's not super creative, but like I said, in these movies, the further you get away from humanoid, the more appealing it is to me.
And also the world design grew so much, like lighting and all that, like building trees became easier for them. They're working out of Maya, and also they continued the practice that was in Shrek 1, which was you are a scene-specific animator of a character, not a character animation assigned to you like you'd be in 2D. And like all of the characters, I believe it was something like there are 600 things on Shrek where you can change a detail on him, of like just in his face, there's like 200 places you can move a thing on his face to act or say words. And this is also when they were working with a lot more animators too on it. This has the interesting note that this is the first CGI work of the legendary James Baxter, who we've talked about in a ton of the Renaissance films.
Oh, that hurts me.
Yes, he had to give up. He had to, after Spirit, they're like, okay, buddy, you gotta learn Maya. I'm sorry to tell you. So if you see a horse character in this movie, Bob, that's animated very well in his stomping around as a stallion, that's James Baxter.
I'll have to pay closer attention on my second watch.
But I don't know nothing about love. Oh, come on, come on.